This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
The sounds of a family joyfully being reunited. Hello, I'm Aline McBall, and for assignment this week, I'm in New Orleans to investigate a case that's been called by legal charities one of the most astonishing miscarriages of justice they've seen in America for years, one that raises uncomfortable questions about race and the country's legal system.
Is that all right?
Three weeks ago, in new clothes that had to be bought for him by his lawyers, and with his arms raised to the skies, Robert Jones walked out of New Orleans Parish Jail to be engulfed by his family. Free at last, for now at least, after 23 years behind bars. Among those he was reunited with, his mother, his sister, and a daughter born after he was jailed.
Didn't I tell you my baby prayed for you every day?
Y'all come on, baby.
This baby prayed for you every day. See her? Every day she prayed for her papa.
Robert, a quick word. How are you feeling?
Oh, man, I feel great. I feel good.
You must have been thinking about this moment for a long time.
Yes. I've been thinking about it for many years. The wheel of justice turns slow, but it turned. The day is a good day. So that's all I'm focusing on right now is a good day. Today is a good day.
What do you want to do today?
That's a good question.
Pick me up.
That's a good question. Man, there's so many things, you know, so many things that I want to do, want to say, but right now I can't find the words.
A judge finally decided he could be released pending a retrial, his original trial having been ruled unfair. And it's not surprising 42-year-old Robert was overwhelmed as he took those first steps into a dreary side street in Midtown New Orleans. When he was first booked in the middle of the night into the very jail he walked out of, the internet barely existed, mobile phones were the size of bricks, and he was just 19. The day after his release, I meet up with Robert again, his first time in a restaurant for more than two decades.
What was yesterday like, walking out?
Oh, it was wonderful. It's a beautiful feeling. It was, this weight of being incarcerated all the years, just being lifted. It's like I wanted to fly, actually.
How can you explain to others what it's like to be in prison for something that you weren't involved in?
A complete nightmare, actually. You can't find a word in the dictionary to describe the cruelty that, you know, I mean, when you were in prison serving a life sentence, even for something that you didn't do, prison life is just rough, man, you know? So it's a deeper grade of injustice to one when you're innocent.
How did you get through it?
My faith in God, and it's a true saying that, you know, the truth still sets you free one day when you can find it. And that was a problem for us. It's actually this finding the truth. The truth was buried so deep. And God is a good God, and God was able to reveal those things.
The truth was indeed buried deep. But this week I'll be talking of our own journey to find it, because it now appears Robert was imprisoned for another man's crime. What's baffling is that that other man had already been caught and sent to prison himself.
You must feel angry, though, as well.
No, a lot of people always ask me that. But I'm not angry. I'm not bitter. I just want accountability. I want somebody to be accountable for the wrong. If someone be held accountable for what they did to me, that means that not only that I'll be vindicated, but guys that's maybe coming behind me to give a fair shake.
This week I'll be looking at how this extraordinary miscarriage of justice happened, who's responsible, and what it tells us about race and justice in America.
This is where it happened. I think it's burning in my brain where the scene happened. I just remember it like it was yesterday.
The story begins in New Orleans' famous French Quarter on a warm April night in 1992. A night police detective James Stewart remembers well.
They were coming from the lower French Quarter area, so they were on the other side of Esplanade. They were at a restaurant over there.
Julie Stott and her boyfriend Peter Ellis were British tourists, celebrating the engagement they hadn't yet even announced to family and friends back home. They'd spend the evening out for dinner, then to watch a Latin jazz band at the Café Brazil before heading back to their hotel in the French Quarter, where, unbeknownst to them, a crime spree had been taking place.
He was pushing me forward on the shoulder, and I was almost falling down. I think he wanted me to fall down because he wanted me to do something wrong so he could justify killing me.
Bethany Acosta was among those robbed by an armed man. She was released unharmed after handing over jewelry. And to the media at the time, she described what happened next.
He then pulled up into the no parking zone in front of this church here, and I told my boyfriend he's going to do it again.
They're walking down the street, they're hand in hand, they're happy, they're just engaged. As soon as they got here, he jumped out on them, pointed a gun at them, and I guess demanded money or whatever. They tried to back away from the guy. The guy had a gun, and during that initial confrontation, the shooter took a shot at Julie and hit her at least twice over here, and then he turned and shot at Peter, and he missed Peter, and then he got back in his car and drove off.
I ran to the Verdi Mart and called 911. As I was walking into the Verdi Mart, I heard shots ring out, and I said, he's got somebody.
One of the bullets hit Julie in her arm, the second in the head, just behind the ear. Later that night in hospital, 27-year-old Julie Stott died.
This will be how the Stott family remembers New Orleans.
An air heavy with sadness still weighs on tourists and residents' minds as they stop where Julie Stott was shot and killed.
The murder of a tourist was huge news here at the time, particularly as it appeared to be the latest in a series of linked armed robberies and a rape, where the witnesses described the same gunman and the same car used. Back in the UK, the media took up the cause of Julie Stott's murder, with one newspaper, The Sun, offering a reward of $10,000 to try to catch the killer.
This would be the one and only media case that I've ever been involved in. I never worked on another case after like it or before. There's a lot of rewards out, and anytime you throw a lot of money like that, you're going to get all kinds of leads. And then, yes, for the most part, they're dead leads.
The media pressure building on investigators was intense when, on the basis of one tip, they arrested Robert Jones, who'd never had a criminal conviction but had been suspected of selling drugs in the past. His arrest, again, hit the headlines.
It's over and done with, hopefully, for Robert Jones.
And tourists say much of their worries are also over.
I'm a little more relaxed now.
In the UK, The Sun tagged Robert, a young black man, the beast of the jungle and a junkie murderer, claiming credit for his arrest after offering the reward. But James Stewart wasn't sure.
I just thought that the headlines got a little overblown on that. You know, we knew there was a lot more work to do. We were having a hard time tying him back to the scene.
Even a triumphant media couldn't drown out the emerging doubts.
In this case, the police have a weapon, but not the one used in the shooting. They have bullets, but not the guns they belong to. But they do have Jones.
How soon was it when you thought, okay, this guy is not our guy?
It took us another week. Then we found the car that we thought we were looking for. And when we found that car and the guy that was registered to that car, it was Lester Jones, not Robert Jones. Then the investigation revealed that it was Lester's car involved in the robbery. And then from the car, we searched his apartment and we found the murder weapon and the bullets that were in his gun, and the ballistics guy over in our lab was able to tie the gun back to the bullet removed from Julie.
So a man named Lester Jones, no relation to Robert, matched the witness descriptions, owned the car described in each of the crimes, and was arrested. The crime spree, which had actually continued after Robert's arrest, finally ended. Lester Jones was found in possession of the items stolen in the robberies and rape, and the gun used to kill Julie Stott.
Our opinion was, we can tie Lester to everything, we can't tie Robert to anything.
And what about tying the two of them together?
We tried that and we couldn't tie them together. And we always felt as though there was only one person involved in the murder, and that was Lester, because everything tied to Lester. We excluded everybody else.
Lester Jones was convicted of Julie Stott's murder and sent to jail.
Can you feel confident that Robert Jones was played no part in the murder of Julie Stott?
Oh, yeah. I firmly believe that to this day. And I do without hesitation.
This is free call from an inmate at
the Louisiana State Penitentiary.
Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hello?
Hi, Robert. It's Aleem.
But Robert Jones was never released. Even though prosecutors knew another man had been found guilty of crimes in the spree, including the murder of Julie Stott, they continued to hold Robert. Then, a couple of years later, 4 years after he was first arrested, in a trial that lasted less than 10 hours and where crucial evidence was withheld, including overwhelming clues that tied Lester Jones to all of the crimes in the spree, astonishing as it sounds, Robert was sent to prison for rape, armed robbery, and the killing of Julie Stott.
I can't even put it in words. Those are very crushing moments. I mean, it felt like I died, you know. And when they said guilty, you know, and I know what guilty means, I know what kind of time I'll face. I mean, life sentence, I was like, it can't be true. But then when it really sunk in, it's kind of like it was a moment of total despair for me. But I always try to maintain a strong will. So I had an exterior aspect of me, you know, appeared to be I was okay, but I was totally crushed internally, you know.
The first time I spoke to Robert was by phone, while he was still in Louisiana's notorious Angola prison, built on a former slave plantation and where, to this day, inmates are put to work picking cotton. Robert had remained behind bars for more than 23 years.
Wow. That's amazing. When did you do this?
This was sometime beginning of last year. This was the beginning of last year.
And
I sent him a picture a while back through the email. I don't know how he got to draw this and make it look exactly like my smile.
Among the things Robert missed was watching his three children grow up, including his daughter Bree, born 8 months after Robert went to jail, who never knew her father as a free man. There are no photos of father and daughter together, but Bree does have a striking picture her father painted in jail of the two of them.
And he's dressed you up in a pharmacy.
Yeah, he dressed me up in a pharmacy jacket with my name on it, and it looked like we was actually together on here. We really wasn't. And he always put his name on the bottom of his pictures. Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing to have.
Yeah, it's nice. Every year I'm thinking, okay, he's going to be home this year, he's going to be home this year. And it's like, okay, I didn't graduate high school, I'm about to graduate college, soon to be in my career, like I still need my father.
But have there been particular moments where you thought, I really, really wish he was here right now?
Yeah, it's been a lot of them. I see my friends, you know, they have their mother and their father, they could do this with them, you know, ride bikes, go out to eat. I never really had them. Like, I had them, but I didn't have him. You know, we always kept a relationship from me going to visit him and talk on the phone with him, but it's like, you're here, but you're not here.
Instead, their relationship's been built on prison visits and phone calls that automatically cut off after 15 minutes.
Yeah, I get emotional and I get upset about it. Like, at the end of our call, it's like, okay, you know, and they say it's 1 minute left. I'm like, oh, Lord, I'm tired of hearing this. You know, I'm just ready for him to come home. It's like, I have so much to tell him, and it's always when I'm ready to talk to him about something, and it's like, oh, we have 1 minute left, and he's like, okay, well, I'm going to talk to you tomorrow. And I'm like, dang, you know, because it's hard for me to open up a lot to anyone.
It's amazing that you still feel so close to your father.
Yeah,
in spite of-
I try to be on his side as much as I could, because I can't imagine being in a position that I can't get myself out of. It's like you're stuck.
You remember times when he's been really down about his situation?
Yeah. It was a couple of years ago when, you know, nothing was shaking. He wasn't going back to court at the time. He wouldn't tell me over the phone, but in the email, he'd be like, well, you know, yesterday I was having a bad day. I wasn't up, and saying how he was emotional, he was sad, but he tried to hide it.
So now, for all those lost years, lost moments, lost memories, who did Robert blame?
Most people would say the system, but the district attorney's office obviously made a whole lot of mistakes, as well as my defense attorney. So those people in those positions didn't do the effective job. I mean, they didn't do what was right. You know, they did what was politically correct.
Many believe one part of the problem was Robert had terrible legal representation. We'd been trying to reach Robert's lawyer at the time, Kirkland Atkins, but he never returned our calls. After several minutes on his doorstep, I noticed some movement in the car parked in the driveway.
Excuse me? Sorry, I didn't see you there.
It looked like a head rising up slowly, then suddenly disappearing down below the window when I turned.
I'm looking for Mr. Atkins?
Many have criticized Mr. Atkins for incompetence during the trial, not knowing Lester Jones had been convicted for crimes in the same spree that Robert was now accused of having committed.
Some are saying it is incompetence on your part that has led to Robert Jones, partly at least, spending 23 years in prison for crimes he didn't commit.
That's impossible. That's impossible. I represented Robert Jones and did not get a fee. So while the people on the side are sitting back criticizing and saying, you could have did this, you could have did that, you could have investigated this, you could have investigated that, they didn't spend the time. They could have went down there and represented Robert Jones.
But you don't feel any responsibility for Robert Jones being in jail?
I did the best I could in representing Robert Jones at the time, during the time, and I think he got the best representation he could have gotten.
Earlier this year, after Robert's case was taken up by lawyers at a justice charity, Innocence Project New Orleans, he won a Supreme Court battle to get a retrial. Bad representation was one of the factors they considered.
So what's your reaction now to the news that the Supreme Court has said he has to have a retrial?
That's excellent. That's excellent. So now the naysayers and the critics and the people in the stand that second-guess my behavior, my action with Robert Jones, they can go try the case. They'll know what to do, what not to do.
But some people would say 20-something years too late.
It's better late than never. The sentence he got is a life sentence. If he can come out in 23 years, that's a blessing. That's a blessing.
But the Supreme Court also awarded Robert a retrial for other, more shocking reasons.
Subsequent to the case itself, now, based on everything that's come out about it, my thought around it is that he didn't get a fair trial.
We met Calvin Johnson, the judge who presided over Robert's trial back in his old courtroom in the New Orleans Criminal Court. It was a building it was clear he'd grown to love over the decades, but there were things that had gone on there that troubled him.
We had a prosecutor's office that was negligent across several cases, across several different time periods, but failed to provide exculpatory information to defendants, and they did it consistently. And so all of that dovetails into what happened with Robert Jones.
Here we had a judge telling us state prosecutors were withholding evidence that might help or completely exonerate a defendant, not just in Robert Jones' case, but many others too. But why? Judge Johnson thinks the very system he was part of was focused on putting as many young black men in prison as it could.
There wasn't anything unique about Robert Jones or that time period as regards that. I mean, that was the driving force in this area for decades before Robert Jones and since Robert Jones. I mean, how we operate the criminal justice system across the South, where race is such an issue, you see the same things play out, where young African-American males ends up being prosecuted much more than their numbers and population dictate.
And what do you think it says about the criminal justice system? What does that say about how much Robert Jones is valued?
He isn't. And the way we look at the Robert Joneses, and this is how we have thought about this, if not today, previous to today, but if he didn't do this, he did something else. And he therefore got away with doing something else, and therefore his punishment is not justified for this particular act, is justified for other things he did and got away with.
An extraordinary admission, but tell it to African Americans living in New Orleans, and they won't be the slightest bit surprised. Most of the allegations of wrongdoing by the prosecutor's office in the city relate to a 30-year period when it was being run by the then district attorney, Harry Connick, father of the jazz singer and musician Harry Connick Jr. So what does the current district attorney, Leon Cannizzaro, say about accusations that in the past prosecutors intentionally withheld evidence, including in the Robert Jones case.
Well, certainly the reputation of this office traditionally has been stained. There is no question about that. This is not the only case. There have been other cases where prosecutors either intentionally or negligently withheld evidence. So I don't think there is a question about that. The best I can do is let's move forward. From the moment I took office, what we said we were going to do is those things are not going to happen. I acknowledge that in 1996, based upon what our appellate courts have said, this man did not receive a fair trial. But again, I think sometimes people equate the fact that someone did not receive a fair trial with the fact that the defendant may be innocent. Those are two separate concepts.
And that's why Mr. Cannizzaro says Robert Jones could still face a retrial for the same crimes, despite what appears to many to be overwhelming evidence they were committed by someone else.
I'm not necessarily sure there is overwhelming evidence that the man is innocent or not guilty of the charges. And again, when we go to trial, we're certainly going to present certain facts, facts that we would believe are going to be consistent with this man's guilt. And the defense has a right to present facts and evidence that they believe is consistent with the fact that he may not be guilty.
But, sir, do you also accept if this was a miscarriage of justice, then 23 years in jail is something very difficult for a man to take, and every extra day there is very hurtful and harmful to him?
I absolutely agree with that. I am not here to put an innocent man in jail. That is not my job. That is not my responsibility.
But you do have the power to release an innocent man.
I have the power to release it, but I have to be sure.
Although he admitted in this interview there had been systemic problems in the district attorney's office in the past, Mr. Cannizzaro had been denying that until now. In fact, he blocked millions of dollars of compensation for another man who'd been on death row for 14 years, but who was released when evidence that prosecutors had hidden finally came to light. In Robert Jones' case, he tried and failed to stop the Supreme Court ruling his trial was unfair. Robert hasn't cleared his name yet, but now he's out. His primary focus is doing just that, not just for himself, but for the others wronged by state prosecutors.
See, for instance, there's a guy that pulled out a pistol, robbed somebody, and killed somebody, right? And you look at him as a cold-blooded murderer, okay? But here you have a district attorney that would hold favorable evidence, send him to prison, and most guys, they die in prison, they're innocent people. Who's the murderer, who's not the murderer? Just because he wears a suit and tie and he goes home every day to his family and he's a professional, he's a murderer as well. You know what I'm saying? They didn't take my entire youth.
Do you think things have changed very much at all in the time you've been in there, or is the same thing still happening time and again?
Same thing. And it's getting worse, though, because a lot of guys have lost hope in the system. And, man, it's rough. The downside of that, I watched a lot of guys die in prison. I watched a lot of guys die in prison. A lot of them was my dear friends, too. So that's another thing that gives me the resilience to fight. My case give a lot of guys hope because of the fact that they know that I'm going to stand and know I'm going to fight. And know I'm going to fight to the end. To create a better system for them. It motivates me, you know. It motivates me to stand tall. You know, it's not over with. You know, it's not over until I'm totally exonerated and I can clear my name. That's when it's over.
Robert's assertion that many others around him while he was in prison were innocent, and of those he knew, he counted 39 who died there during his 23 years, is something that didn't surprise his original trial judge, Calvin Johnson.
Our justice system is replete with Robert Joneses. Replete with individuals who, because of how the justice system has operated over the last decades, picked a number, we've ended up with a Robert Jones result. These cases come out every day.
How do you feel, how does it play on your mind that you were the man who presided over that trial that led to Robert Jones now being in prison for 23 years?
All of them, not just Robert Jones, all of them who were wrongly prosecuted and convicted weighs heavily on me, which is why to this day I try my best to deal with the reality of where we are in terms of how we go at these cases. And so, yeah, Robert Jones is one, and that plays out on me. It does. But then there are so many others that I know of that were wrongly prosecuted and wrongly convicted.
Having dissected this particular miscarriage of justice, and one so obvious, where a man was convicted of a crime another had already been imprisoned for, and having got a sense of what it robbed an innocent man of, it was shocking to think that this was being played out so many more times, and in cases where perhaps innocence was not so obvious, and where the truth was buried even deeper.
That's all for this edition of Assignment, presented by Aleem McBool and produced by Ashley Semler and me, James Fletcher. To listen to more editions of the program, go to bbcworldservice.com.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.